Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. We're going to start today with a clip from a 66-year-old film that was, pretty literally, damage control. You could even call it propaganda, intended to make some Utah residents feel better about what was happening in their own backyard. It was produced by the U.S. Air Force, the Department of Defense, and the Atomic Energy Commission.
If you were driving from Los Angeles to Salt Lake City on U.S. Highway 91, you'd pass through St. George, Utah, population 4,562, just a short way from the state line of Nevada. It's pre-dawn, 5 in the morning. Pretty deserted at this hour. Everything is closed down. Everyone's asleep. Everyone, that is, except a milkman. Been delivering over the same route for 12 years. Never missed a day. And a police officer patrols the lonely downtown beat. And another night owl keeps his place open 24 hours for tourists coming through. Since the rest of the town was sound asleep, only our night owl saw it, that great flash in the western sky. An atomic bomb at the Nevada test site 140 miles to the west. But it's old stuff to St. George. Routine. They've seen a lot of them ever since 1951. Nothing to get excited about anymore.
The full film is held at the National Archives. We'll be featuring a couple of other pieces from it throughout the show. But nothing to get excited about anymore, says the anodyne everyman Hollywood narrator. And if you lived in St. George in the 50s, it could have felt like that. Beginning in 1951, and over the course of 11 years, more than 100 open-air atomic tests would take place at the Nevada test site. And despite assurances from the military and federal agencies that the tests wouldn't do any harm outside the boundaries of the test site, they did. Radiation from the tests landed in areas far afield of Yucca Flat, inside the government-controlled area. Hotspots were recorded at the mouths of the canyons on Salt Lake City's East Bench, and as far away as Troy, New York, 3,000 miles to the east. But the Atomic Energy Commission underplayed the danger of radiation, sometimes referring to radiation exposure in terms of sunshine units, and again claiming that the fallout did not constitute a hazard outside the official test site. But in stark contrast to those claims, Army personnel stationed in the area were routinely reassigned if the badges they wore indicated more than the maximum allowed exposure. Which is to say, federal officials were fully aware of the danger the radiation posed. Former Utah Governor Scott Matheson, who grew up in southwestern Utah, said that as a kid he used to get up early to watch the detonations at the test site from his home in Iron County. In 1979, in a New York Times article about increased childhood leukemia rates in St. George, the governor was quoted saying, "You could see the blasts flash across the entire sky and feel the earth shake, and then sometime later you could feel the particles settling down on you like fine dust."
After a shot has been fired, the atomic cloud, like a giant vacuum cleaner, has sucked up dirt and debris from the earth and is full of radioactive particles. Is it dangerous? Yes, right now it is. You wouldn't want to go into it, but neither would you deliberately walk into a blazing fire. You have to use common sense.
The radioactive fallout from the atomic blasts at the Nevada test site just 60 miles northwest of Las Vegas caused a lot of immediate problems. Just as one of too many examples, in St. George, Agatha Mannering was out weeding her garden when radiation from one of the early explosions descended on the town. In later testimony before Congress, Mannering described the extreme weakness she immediately felt. She didn't even have the energy to bathe herself. And then the scalding burning in her lungs and sinuses and throat that came the next day, and then her hair falling out in the days and weeks to come, and an illness that lasted for months. In 1979, at a congressional hearing in Washington, she reported that while none of her ancestors had been prone to cancer, six people in her family had contracted it. Speaking of cancer, Governor Matheson, who grew up in the area, later died of multiple myeloma, a cancer he attributed to his exposure to radiation from the tests.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt this program to bring you important news. Word has just been received from the Atomic Energy Commission that due to a change in wind direction, the residue from this morning's atomic detonation is drifting in the direction of St. George. It is suggested that everyone remain indoors for 1 hour or until further notice. There is no danger. This is simply routine Atomic Energy Commission safety procedure. To prevent unnecessary exposure to radiation, it is better to take cover during this period. Parents need not be alarmed about children at school. No recesses outdoors will be permitted. Please stay indoors and advise your friends and neighbors who may not hear this announcement to do likewise.
There are so many downwinder stories. Stories of people who were directly, or maybe not so directly, exposed to radioactive fallout from these tests. And there are the secondary effects, if you can call them that. Mother's breast milk, for example, would concentrate the radiation the moms had been exposed to, leading to even more dire effects for infants. There's the fact that livestock ate radiation-coated grass, and then that radiation turned up on dinner plates in the form of steaks, or in cow's milk that kids poured on their cereal. Not to mention the grisly deaths of thousands of sheep in Nevada and Utah from radiation exposure, and on and on. And in fact, it's kind of hard to know how to draw a line around where the damage done comes to an end. Radiation went, well, all over the place, not just impacting communities adjacent to the test site, like St. George. And of course, we're not even talking about the radiation exposure that other people involved in the Cold War nuclear arms race got from, say, mining or transporting uranium. To try to make some amends for that damage, in 1990, Congress passed the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA.
Okay, RECA is the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, which exposes people harmed by nuclear weapons testing and development, specifically the mining, because there were so many people who got sick.
That's Mary Dixon, a Salt Lake City writer and journalist who has spent a lifetime advocating on behalf of downwinders.
And over the years, people had tried to get compensation. There was they tried to do it with legislation because the court cases just were turned over saying you can't sue the American government, sovereign immunity. So they had to resort to legislation to get compensation.
And they did. They succeeded in doing that in 1990.
1990.
And there, as you hinted at, there's two components. One is sort of people who were directly exposed through atmospheric atomic tests. And then there were those who were involved in other aspects of the nuclear program who could get compensation. But for the former group, there are some geographic limitations. Can you talk about that?
Oh, my God. Okay, RECA never was comprehensive enough. It was always a faulty bill. I don't mean to sound ungrateful. It was good. It passed. But it was not a good enough bill. It was too flawed. They drew a circle around mostly rural counties in southern Utah, Nevada, and northern Arizona, and it never covered enough of the people who were affected. And at the time, I think they weren't really knowing or admitting how far that fallout went. But there have been studies since RECA passed in 1990 showing how far the fallout went and how many people could have been affected.
One example of the studies that Mary is talking about there was published by an Arizona University researcher named Keith Myers. Myers extrapolated exposure to a radioisotope of iodine called I-131, something that entered the bloodstream of many Americans through the consumption of milk, and he concluded that radioactive fallout from American nuclear tests led to as many as 690,000 American deaths from 1951 to 1973. That's the high end of his estimate. The low end, 340,000 deaths. Oh, and by the way, those deaths occurred in places far away from Western nuclear test sites.
Oh, if you look at this map, it's Richard Miller's map, and I pull this thing out all the time and send it all over the place. Utah's almost completely blacked out, as are other areas. The Midwest is hard hit. In fact, there was a study in 2019, and it concluded that up to 500,000 people in the Midwest and in the East Coast likely died of cancers and other diseases related to contaminated agriculture.
From the nuclear tests, the above-ground nuclear tests in the West.
Right, right. And it did. It blew all. I mean, the jet streams in this country blow westerly. They knew where those winds blew, which means fallout got carried by the jet stream across the country and would fall out when it collided with a rainstorm, a snowstorm, and that's how it got across the country into upstate New York, into Canada, and into our food chain and our bodies.
To date, RECA, the compensation measure passed by Congress back in 1990, RECA has paid nearly $2.5 billion total to 38,500 people. Downwinders, those who developed certain cancers and who lived in specific parts of Utah, Arizona, or Nevada between 1951 and 58, or during July of 1962 when tests were conducted, have been the bulk of the recipients of those payouts, amounting to more than 24,000 people. Others receiving payments include on-site participants, meaning those who worked at the test site, uranium miners and millers, and people who worked transporting uranium ore, generally in trucks or trains. Here again is Mary Dixon.
Okay, you have to prove that you lived in those areas during certain years, primarily from 1951 to 1958 and the summer of 1962. So that's always been difficult for people, especially if you were a child. How do you gather up any proof that that's where you were? You have to have your medical records because it covers 18 cancers and one leukemia. So you have to have held on to all those medical records. If you were a child, you likely did not. Plus, it's very hard for uranium miners who were on Navajo Reservation, for instance, because a lot of those mines were on Native lands. And they don't sometimes have addresses, some don't have electricity, running water, and don't go to regular doctors. So it's harder.
Yeah, and I also read that for, I mean, the fund is also to help compensate those who are survivors of people who have died, and that sometimes marriages weren't documented the same way or the official way that they wanted.
Right, right.
On so, a reservation, yeah.
And this new bill hopefully would make that process easier.
Fundamentally, the new bill Mary Dixon is talking about aims to extend and expand RECA. Without the program being renewed, the compensation offered by the government to try to make amends for the damage done would come to an end in July of next year.
RECA, for instance, helped those people who applied get $50,000. For people whose loved ones had died, if you were a child of someone who died, you could apply for them. I've known people who did that. So it gave $50,000. If you were a uranium mining worker, it was $75,000. Well, now all claimants who apply under the new bill, it would be $150,000. Because let's face it, $50,000 is not going to cover all your medical bills or even a chemo treatment. So that's very important. It also expands the time frame because currently downwinders of the Trinity test site in New Mexico have never been covered.
I'm going to interrupt here for a second. Just in case you've forgotten, the Trinity test was the very first detonation of a nuclear device, the first nuclear bomb test ever. It happened at 5:29 a.m. on July 16th of 1945 at the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico.
And so it makes it so that they can be covered for that test that was conducted in 1945. So it moves those dates back. And it also moves the dates for uranium miners because it did not cover any uranium miners who worked in the industry after 1971. So it adds that. So it does broaden who can get it. It broadens the time frame. Most importantly, also, it extends RECA because without this legislation passing, that expires next July, meaning no one gets anything anymore.
And Dixon says the new bills would expand who is eligible for RECA compensation from a geographic perspective, broadening it from those who contracted certain cancers in just a few counties near to the Nevada test site to those who fell ill within the entirety of various Western states.
This new bill that's been introduced in the Senate and the bill that's been introduced in the House, they include all of Utah, all of Nevada, all of Arizona, plus Colorado, New Mexico, Idaho, and Montana, as well as Guam. So they do expand the area throughout the West because Westerners were particularly hard hit. So that would mean that people in those areas could finally apply for compensation.
You know, Mary, I think that some people, just going back again to the amount of compensation, I think that some people will hear the figure, $150,000, which is what these bills envision. They'll think that that's quite a lot, but I guess when you consider...
It's not. Yeah. It's not. When you consider the medical bills and just the effects on your life and your family, I know somebody was telling me, well, you know, the fund for first responders of 9/11, they get $1.3 million. And you know, it makes you think, okay, wait, why are their lives worth so much more? Because they were killed by terrorists, and our lives are worth less because we were killed by our own government.
It is the total amount of radiation that is important. That is why very careful considerations are given for firing every atomic test shot, so that the fallout will add as little radiation as possible to that of natural background sources. Yes, the very nature of testing weapons for national defense requires we accept the possibility of some exposure to additional radiation. There is some potential risk. But this additional radiation has been kept far below harmful amounts in areas beyond a few miles outside the test site boundaries.
I know you have a personal story on this front as well. You grew up here in Salt Lake City.
I did.
And one of the cancers on the list is one that you contracted.
Thyroid. I grew up in the Canyon of Mary of Salt Lake City. I was diagnosed with thyroid cancer in my 20s and had my thyroid removed and parathyroid and had radiation. And then members of my family also. I have a sister who kind of helped me on this issue, and she died of lupus. And I have another sister who has cancer, another sister who has autoimmune diseases. But my sister who died, before she died, she and I had made a list of people in a 5-block area that we grew up in. And that list got up to 54 people who had various cancers, tumors, autoimmune diseases. And we always thought something must have happened to us. And I met a gentleman, your father, at a hearing, and I had gotten up and given my testimony, and then I did not know him at the time, and he gave testimony of the people in his neighborhood who had had cancers and how high the rates were there. Well, he just lived higher up than we did. So there are definitely pockets, but there are people all across this state who have had cancers, and they have no idea that they're downwinders. In fact, whenever I would tell people I was a downwinder, first thing they'd say is, oh, I didn't know you grew up in St. George. Yeah. And I'd have to pull out the map that showed how far the fallout went. I said, no, I grew up in Salt Lake, but I am a downwinder.
Mary Dixon, a downwinder, but who is not identified as such yet by the U.S. government.
Here's an example that I like to give people. Think of this summer in Salt Lake City, how our skies have been filled with smoke from the fires, primarily in California. That's the smoke we see. And I know people in other states, Montana, Colorado, and Wyoming, who talked about the smoke in their areas. And a friend of mine in New York said, oh, yeah, the smoke made the sky orange behind the Statue of Liberty. That's smoke that we can see. You don't always see the radiation. You don't see it. But it goes as far as that smoke did. And I think that's a really visual image for people to understand how it got carried so far.
So what is happening with the push to re-up and to expand RECA? You said that there are two bills. They are in Congress. They have sponsors. Can you tell us about who's behind this push to make this happen?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Senator Mike Crapo, Republican from Idaho, has been the one making this push, and he has for years tried to expand RECA because of the incidence of cancers in his state. In fact, this is interesting. Gem County in Idaho was number 2 It was ranked number two in terms of fallout. A county, Montana, was ranked number three. So Crapo has for years tried to get this through. He teamed up with, this time, Senator Ben Ray Lujan of New Mexico, and he joined him, and they got some co-sponsors. There are, this is bipartisan. It's bipartisan legislation. Lujan's replacement in the House in New Mexico, her name is Teresa Ledger Fernandez. She introduced the legislation there, and Burgess Owens of Utah is a co-sponsor of that. There are other co-sponsors, too. I know they are trying very hard to get even more co-sponsors to sign on, so there's a big push for that, because this really, I cannot express the urgency of this bill, not just because it runs out in 2022, the current compensation, but because people are dying. I mean, we are literally losing people who have waited decades for justice. I have lost so many people just this year. J. Preston Truman, who was a real leader in this fight from Enterprise, lived in Malad, he died. He died in February because he got another cancer. People's cancers come back. They get other cancers. They get health complications. So, the story's not over. People are still getting sick.
Attention, please. Minus 15 seconds.
I have a lot of people say to me, that was a long time ago. It wasn't a long time ago, because the way radiation works, it affects you the rest of your life, your health issues. So, and people can still get sick. Some of those cancers take 40 years to show up. We will never really know how many downwinders there were. We really will never know. And that kind of kills me. And the vast majority of downwinders will never know they were. There are downwinders in Utah who don't know they are. I've met people even in areas that are compensated who didn't know they were. And I've told them, well, you're eligible for compensation. And there was one woman who says, oh, but the government needs that money. It's like they didn't need your left breast. So, it's been really hard for me, because all the people I worked so hard with on this in Utah, they've all died.
What then was the story at St. George? Here are the facts. The go or no-go meeting, after carefully reviewing all factors, found conditions were favorable. The go-ahead signal was given, and the shot fired the following morning. The predicted path of fallout was to the south of the city. Then the local wind changed. The cloud approached the city. The word was spread throughout the community, and the citizens calmly took cover. 1 hour and 50 minutes later, at 11:25 a.m., the all-clear announcement was broadcast. Actually, when the invisible cloud had passed, the total amount of radiation deposited on St. George was far from hazardous.
At the beginning of this episode, I mentioned that the 1955 Atomic Energy Commission film we've been excerpting throughout the show was Damage Control. It's not the name of the film. That's what the film intended to do. It was produced partly in response to concern from residents of St. George, who routinely heard warnings on the radio telling them to stay indoors, or who spoke with neighbors who owned Geiger counters that were registering the high levels of radiation, or who had their cars stopped to be checked for fallout and then washed down by military officials. A number of St. George residents appeared in the film: the milkman, the policeman, the gas station attendant, a number of mothers and children and shop workers. In the 1993 book American Ground Zero, The Secret Nuclear War, by photojournalist Carol Gallagher, one of those who appeared in the film, Elmer Pickett, owner of the Pickett Lumber Hardware Store in downtown St. George, explained that two-thirds of the people who appeared in the film later died of cancer.
we have to do right by those that were harmed. We just have to do right. It's imperative. And it's easy. I mean, people need to contact their representatives and urge them to support. I'm going to give you the bill number, HR 5338. I mean, you don't have to know all the details and think I'm not a scientist. I don't know this enough. Just call their offices and say, please support HR 5338. This is a matter of social justice. In the Senate, they should call our senators, Lee and Romney, and urge them to sign on to Senate Bill 2798. Write it down, S2798. I think it's important they hear from people. Very important.
Have you been in touch with Lee or Romney's office?
We have tried. We've tried to set up meetings, and we have not been contacted by either of those offices. We're still trying and looking for new avenues to do that. We have been in touch with John Curtis's office, and we're trying to set up meetings with the other members of our delegation. So hopefully we can meet with them and offer them not just our stories, but our expertise and our perspectives on the issue. And I just think if the members of Congress could hear these stories, it would make a difference, because it's a tragedy. It's a national tragedy. I know there was a woman who wrote a book called Half Truths and Half Lives who said that nuclear testing didn't prevent nuclear war. It was a nuclear war, and we are its casualties.
Again, that's Mary Dixon. She is a downwinder, an advocate for victims of nuclear testing programs in the United States and around the world, and a journalist and playwright. Mary wrote the play Exposed, about the human cost of nuclear testing. A couple of quick thanks before we wrap up. Some of the research for this episode came from the remarkable Mojave Project, an online resource compiled by the Joshua Tree-based artist and educator Kim Stringfellow. I'll put a link to her very thorough dispatch entitled Downwind Upshot Knothole at our website, kcpw.org. I also drew on resources from the site atomicarchive.com and from the National Archives. And of course, my thanks again to Mary Dixon for joining the show. That's it for In the Hive today from KCPW, a listener-supported, entirely independent, local public radio resource. Find podcasts at our website, kcpw.org, or through your podcast app. I'm Roger McDonough. Again, thanks for tuning in. Both Sides of the Aisle is coming up next.
Then you may ask, why were the people asked to stay indoors? For a very simple reason. The Atomic Energy Commission doesn't take chances on safety. It is the AEC's policy to keep to a minimum any exposure of persons to radiation. This wide safety margin controls AEC's attitude toward radiation involved in any of its activities. So the citizens of St. George were asked to go indoors to avoid unnecessary exposure. The amount of radioactivity that fell on St. George was not dangerous. But the AEC felt the precaution to avoid exposure was good common sense.